Hello, everyone. My name is Louisa Morse. I am the Division Chair of STR, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this symposium where new modes of strategizing will be addressed. This year, STR is running a number of events related to the impact and relevance of strategic management, hence our very nice background here. So please keep an eye out on the STR homepage or social media for advertisements of the next events. I'm sure we're going to have a fascinating conversation today. I've been looking forward to it. And thank you very much to all of the panelists for being here, all of the participants, and of course to Richard Whittington for organizing this session today. I'm going to hand over now to Richard to introduce the event and today's speakers.
Thank you, Louise. Welcome, everybody. Lovely to see you all. And thank you to the panel of speakers. We've got a great topic, new modes of strategizing. It seems particularly relevant at the moment as we have a technological revolution going on. We have new challenges around ESG and grant and societal change. And we also have, I think, a greater interest in accountability around strategy. So many more people are many more organizations are experimenting with more collaborative and open forms of strategy. So what we propose to do is have the five presentations in a modified alphabetical order. So we'll start with Callan Anthony, who will be talking about implementation issues and innovation. We'll follow with Fleur, who will talk about collaborative and inter-organizational strategizing. Then we move on to Julia Houts, who will talk about open strategy and more inclusive and participative forms of strategizing. Henk will talk about strategizing for social as well as economic value, responding to some of the societal changes that are going on at the moment. And then Siobhan O'Mahony will conclude with a presentation discussing methods for strategizing research, particularly in the field. And in that sense, what she has will be relevant to us all. The presentations will be about 10 to 12 minutes long. I will try and make sure that we move on time. There will be time for perhaps one question at the end of each presentation, depending on how presentations go. But we really invite you to contribute via the chat. So if you can use the chat function to record your questions, to a certain extent, others amongst the audience will be able to respond to those questions, but also so too will the presenters in their time. Okay, so please use the chat function and also use the chat function if you can to make suggestions for readings or make general observations or maybe mention your own research, which you think is relevant. So please use the chat function. The panelists will try and respond to as many of the questions as possible via the chat function, as well as immediately after their own presentations. So I think it's probably time for me to usher in the presenters. And the first is Callan. So Callan will be talking about innovation and implementation and strategizing. Thank you very much. Callan, you're off.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you so much, Richard, for organizing and for including me. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm so excited to learn from everyone. As Richard said, this morning I'm going to be talking about implementation and innovation. So I wrote this paper a couple of years ago, and it is an ASQ, and it was this deep ethnographic study of a bank's adoption of these new algorithmically driven analytical technologies. So I was deeply embedded in this firm for a couple of years, and I was tracing across different groups sort of the implementation processes and practices and the consequences of how people made sense of their technologies. But the decision to adopt these new analytical technologies was a strategic decision. And the purpose for the bank was to enhance their capabilities and performance around analytical work. And there were a couple of different goals or driving intention here, which included product quality. So how, enhancing the reliability and consistency of analysis that was important for clients. to make the analytical process more efficient, and also to help with the development of expertise, particularly in some of the junior knowledge workers. So to enhance sort of the human capital. And so this is how, you know, the analytical process looked before these tools. We have publicly traded filings that bankers would, you know, sometimes take from a physical library, but increasingly online, that then they would interpret and manually calculate financial analysis, which would then underpin advice to clients. So these new technologies instead, drawing on algorithms, would interpret and process these filings and crunch sort of pre-prepared analysis into Excel. And so what this meant is that the role of the banker shifted from manual calculation to sort of overseeing, interpreting, and managing these analytical tools that were instead performing this work. Again, you know, the intention was around enhancing the capabilities around reliability, efficiency, and development of expertise. But what I found is actually the realization of the strategic value of these tools was dependent on local emergent task configurations. And these local task configurations had significant impact as to how these analytical technologies affected reliability and particularly expertise. So in some groups, well, basically across the firm, I found that junior bankers, those junior workers, became the default users of the analytical technologies. But their tasks around interpreting the outputs of these tools differed considerably. So some groups, we had what I call this partitioning task configuration, where based on these interactions between junior and senior members, tasks of using technologies and interpreting their outputs was split across hierarchical lines, versus other groups where junior bankers were actually included or co-constructed in that interpretation process. And these differences shaped whether or not the algorithms and the technologies were understood or whether they were black boxed, whether the knowledge outputs were consistent versus inconsistent, depending on how the technologies were used. And then also it shaped how junior bankers and whether junior bankers developed key expertise, which also appeared to be associated with their career trajectories. So if groups partitioned these tasks, I observed more black boxing, more inconsistent analysis, junior bankers not developing expertise and actually appearing to have higher rates of turnover from the occupation. So why am I telling you all this, right? So what I'm really pushing for is the importance of paying attention to implementation processes. But when we take a step back and consider sort of broadly where the focus of a lot of our literature is, it's really disproportionately attentive to the strategy making process and strategic decision making. And so we examine factors like capabilities, economic factors, cognition, power politics, the processes and practices of this sort of, you know, firm level strategy making, decision making process. And when we do look at outcomes, we tend to sort of look at the adoption of a change or an action as the endpoint. So that could be, you know, implementing or producing a new technology. It could be the incorporation of new roles, changes to decision-making authority, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is particularly pronounced and this challenge is compounded when we look at what our typical measures of innovation and technological change are, right? So we look at patents, we look at dollars spent, and we look at binary measures of action, such as adoption, not adoption, entrance, not entrance, production, not production. So based on this focus, we would have missed the variance that I observed in my study, where, you know, we would have the decision-making process at the firm level to adopt these technologies, which, you know, there was contestation, there was discussion, is this important for the capabilities of the firm? And then sort of this, the selection of tools sort of coming out the other end. And we see, like, you know, yes, they adopted, yes, they purchased these licenses. But what we would miss is how, in my case, you know, task configurations that emerged out of hierarchical relationships affected whether, you know, that strategic value was actually realized. And this matters now, I think, more than ever, particularly as we are at what appears to be a fundamental technological shift. And we're in the early stages of it. So even though I've told you a story from one paper, one setting, one firm, one decision, I think this is a flashlight that sort of highlights some impending opportunities and challenges as we think about AI in particular. So just to illustrate, I went to the HBR website yesterday, and I grabbed a couple of headlines. And as we can see, you know, the conversation is, how is AI going to affect strategy? How do you get your employees on board with AI? And this also is reflected in recent scholarship and conversations we're having in our journals. So, you know, AI is going to change the nature and source of competitive advantage. It's going to be, you know, something that firms are going to need in order to compete. It's going to affect the cognitive capabilities of decision makers. And yet, what I want to call for and really impress upon us as a community is the importance of moving beyond sort of the firm level decision making, focuses on immediate action to trace through how implementation is actually going to affect the strategic value that is realized from these technologies, and more broadly, the question of how does AI shape firm strategy. So I believe we need more field research, and we need more ethnographic studies of AI. So I wrote a paper recently that just came out in OrgSci with Beth Betschke and Anne-Laure Fayard, where we talk about the need for grounded studies of AI within organizations, but that we require sort of a new set of methodological tools and techniques in order to do so. So in this paper, we talk about what we call relational ethnography. So how do we actually study these technologies within organizations and within firms to really trace their consequences? So I thought I would end with a couple of implications for strategy scholars and some questions going forward. You know, of course, I think still studying strategy making about AI is incredibly important and really valuable in this moment. And you know, I would be super excited about research that looks at cross comparisons of firms, geographies, and also AI systems. But if we think about, you know, how does implementation of AI unfold and with what consequences, some questions could be things like, how do firms restructure around producing quality data for AI systems? How is AI integrated, translated, where, by whom, and with what consequences? How does coordination with and around these tools unfold? You know, what shapes misunderstanding, misinterpretation, or, you know, interpretation at all? And then how does the promise of AI, you know, we have a lot of rhetoric about what these technologies are going to do to society, economy, firms, how does these promises stack up with reality? And then I think, you know, we could return to some classic questions and some work by Mark Zabrocki about, you know, the rhetoric and reality of some of these innovative promises, and ask questions like, how do narratives about what firms are doing actually affect strategic outcomes? That's all I got. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to some questions.
That's fabulous. Thank you, Callan. I was getting a bit worried early on. You were going to say the strategizing stuff was irrelevant, but I think we're going to be holding all this one together. So I've suggested to people, we've got, I think, 2 or 3 minutes for questions before we hand on to Fleur. But so if anyone wants to raise a hand, or ideally just send in a question via chat, please do. We've got a couple of minutes for Callan to respond. Has anyone got reflections or questions? There are a couple already in the chat. Bashak, yeah. Louise has got some. Callan, so what do you want to respond to?
Yeah, so I'll take I'll take Basak's question about how AI as a technology differs from existing studies like those carried out by Barley on technology and organizational work. I mean, to me, like, I would say that it is incredibly important. And I think the field, there's a rich and very mature body of literature on technology and organizing that feels very relevant to strategic questions right now. It's really tough to not fall into this trap of, oh, it's a new technology, therefore everything is new. We have theories about how technologies affect organizations. We have theories about how, you know, workers interpret, make sense of, and interact with new technologies. So I would say incredibly relevant. I would also say that the materiality of these technologies is different than a CT scanner. And again, not to continue to push my own work, but in this OrgSci paper, we discuss the particular challenges that AI poses that are unique and different, which require new methods and potentially new theories. So I would say check out that paper for our thoughts on how to do that.
Thanks very much. That's a nice question, and Karen, that's a great answer. And I think Siobhan will be able to respond to some of these method questions as well and pick them up later. I hope that's not putting undue burden on you, Siobhan. So thank you very much, Karen. Shall we move on? And I thank you too for keeping so nicely to time, to Fleur.
Thanks, Richard. And I think I'll pick up a little bit on Hella's focus on innovation here as well. But I'll talk specifically about the interorganizational and collaborative aspects of strategizing. And I do so in the context of cross-sector innovation networks. And by that, I mean initiatives where very diverse parties collaborate for solutions for societal challenges. So think private companies, public, civil, NGOs, educational institutes, governments. And as an example, and I guess I'm standing a little bit in the way here, consider NEL. It's a network that includes academic hospitals, universities, health tech, but also insurance, IT service providers, and local hospitals and patient organizations. And at NEL, these parties really try to collaboratively strategize for solutions for complex healthcare problems. And one of these regards a post-operative care solution where they use new digital technologies to release people after heart surgery to their homes safer and sooner. But the challenge here is really how to organize the collective adoption. So I think this focus on implementation is also a big part of my presentation. So how do you get these solutions to be adopted by a vast range of heterogeneous parties? And NEL is a forum where actors are jointly strategizing around these thorny questions about, you know, value creation and capture trade-offs for all these individual parties. Now, these cross-sector innovation networks like NEL are becoming more prevalent. And I think in the Netherlands, but also in many countries in Europe, they're really popping up like mushrooms. And I think that's due to two interrelated developments. So first, I think there is in general this growing awareness that societal challenges need collective responses, right? That no single organizations can address them in isolation. And I think a case in point is this 17th societal development goal as formulated by the UN, where there is one dedicated for these partnerships that are needed for these solutions to really get adopted. And a second development is the so-called mission-oriented innovation policies that are on the rise. So these mission-driven innovation policies are adopted by governments, but also innovation funds, in the hope to accelerate development, but mostly also the implementation of solutions for societal challenges. And the idea is that by having all the actors at the table early on, it will increase the chances of success to facilitate adoption and, I guess, to, you know, overcome this infamous valley of death. The challenge here, I think, from a research point of view, is how to actually conceptualize what is happening in these networks. And what I found very useful is this early research from the 80s on collective strategy that was rooted in ecological and systems approaches. And I think this stream of work already points to the importance of all the interdependencies among organizations that are so important, especially when actors are trying to collaboratively, you know, adapt and shape their environment. It's not just about responding to changes, but it's really about trying to drive changes. And I think also this more recent work on collaborative strategy is very relevant. And this points to three important points, in my opinion. So first of all, that we should consider different phases of strategizing, not just the formulation of goals and missions, but also the adoption of solutions. And that we should study not only organizational action, but also collective and really in tandem. And thirdly, that the collaborative that it introduces these key questions around who is contributing what resources. Now, today I'll argue that these cross-sector innovation networks challenge some of our fundamental theories in strategic management, and I'll draw on my ongoing research to make two of these reflections. So the first regards the way we understand resources and resource complementarity in context of collaboration. And the second one is how we understand coordination and governance of collaboration. And I'll argue that the, you know, vast theories around strategic management on alliances, networks, and ecosystems are mostly very ill-equipped to deal with what I think is one of the key characteristics of these networks, namely that they have all these unknown interdependencies between organizations. So the first part is about this move from resources to resourcing. In most of the literature on collaboration and strategic management, we see this assumption that there are specific resource needs that are known upfront for which collaborations are set up, right? But because these networks, they are really aiming to address wicked problems, they tend to have a rather wide scope. Although they may focus on very specific challenges, the solutions that are needed are by no means concrete or well-defined. And there are so many different possible routes forward, and it's impossible to know upfront which directions are most promising or, you know, will yield the best chances of success. And given that wide scope, actors that participate in these networks that are jointly strategizing, they really have difficulties understanding upfront what resources they need. So this assumption that you can see collaboration to revolve around the search for the missing puzzle piece that is, you know, underlying all this literature on alliances and R&D consortia, that really doesn't hold in the context of these cross-sector innovation networks. And in my recent research, we're trying to conceptualize the role of resources by drawing on work by Martha Feldman, specifically around resourcing cycles, I should say. Martha Feldman introduced this more dynamic conceptualization of resources, and that's rooted in practice theory. And it really directs the attention of the researcher to the process of how resources are actively generated, or as they call it, put to use when enacting a goal or schema. And in that perspective, pretty much anything can be a potential resource. I'm finding that it is particularly useful to understand the endogenous dynamics through which in these networks, goals, but also resources and solutions tend to co-evolve over time. It's not so linear. And in that regard, I find it a very useful lens to explain how collaborative strategy paths can be formed, so how actors can find their direction and make progress over time in specifying, but also experimenting and, you know, provisionally adopting these solutions, aiming for widespread adoption ultimately. So I think this is one of the lenses that I think is very useful when we're trying to counter this dominant linear depiction that we see in a lot of the collaboration research. And then second of all, the second line of research focuses on how we actually can coordinate and govern these collaborations. And my initial research is showing that these networks, they tend to evolve quite radically into different types of activities that really need different resources and different governance structures. So what we're finding is that many of these networks, that they initially focus on knowledge sharing, where actors, you know, all bring in their respective perspective and expertise, and that those activities seem best suited to, and then I'm drawing on the work by Pravin Kanas and York Sido, on network administrative organization structures, where there is a dedicated entity that really tries to get an overview of all the different actors and their respective resources. But then, to avoid ending up like talking shops, right? All talk, no actions. Many of these networks over time shift at least some of their activities to experimentation, right? Really trying out what actually works in practice. But then the challenge is different. It is about how to get actors to commit. Who is actually willing to commit the resources for experimentation? And we're finding that in those situations, a lead organization seems best. So someone who really takes on the task to convince others to join in the experiment and really lead in specifying solutions. But then there is still the risk that these networks, that they never yield anything except for pilot projects. So there are many networks that get stuck, and they look back on this wake of all these different pilots, but it really failed to ultimately drive adoption. And the issue here, like in the example from Nell, is that at the system level, there are these value creation and capture trade-offs that have to be reconsidered for actors to really collectively adopt. And for that, we're finding that a more shared governance structure seems to be working best, where decision-making based on consensus is helping to facilitate the kind of buy-in that you need. So the governance challenge here is, how do you structure the collaboration and network given these changing nature of the activities? And what we're finding in our research is that the stable governance structures are very ill-suited, and that many of these initiatives really get stuck in one of the strategizing phases. So what we're proposing is that we need a more layered and hybrid approach, where subparts of the networks adopt different structures to support moving to that next phase of strategizing. So in summary, I guess these new forms, in my view, of collective strategizing, they really challenge our existing management theories. And I think they provide a very nice opportunity to develop new theory, especially theories that take seriously emergent interdependencies between actors and radical uncertainty. So I'm hoping that this will also inspire others to do research on this context, because I feel that we're spending huge amounts of public funds on these initiatives, and it would be wonderful if we can also make impact through researching these emergent phenomena. So thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to discussions and questions.
Fabulous. Thank you, Fleur. We are still a little bit ahead of time, I think. So we have time for a couple of questions, if anyone would like to ask them. I think there's some nice resonances with what Julia will be talking about in terms of open strategy. Stick some questions in the chat or raise a digital hand. And I think we've got time for one or two. He's going to step forward. Well, I will then.
Things get stuck at the pilot stage? I think it's a very interesting one. I think because many of these initiatives still emphasize, like I think we do in our literature, that it is about who is the value proposition aiming for? So we should be centered on, say, patients, or we should be centered on who is paying for the service. But I think, like what we see in some of the ecosystems work, is there are, it's only as strong as the weakest link. So if we fail to address all these thorny questions about how we're redistributing value in systems like healthcare, these wonderful solutions will never see the light of day, because the system cannot sort of incorporate them. That is my hunch, but I haven't studied that specifically enough, I guess.
Thanks very much, Flo. We might have time for a quick one, or we should move. Well, very quick it would have to be. I think perhaps we should super. So we got some questions. Right. Introduce resourcing. Yeah. Any quick
yeah,
suggestions on
resourcing, Flo? There's a wonderful paper also in the Academy of Management Learning, authored by Martha Feldman, on how she draws on resourcing theory, and she uses it as a nice tool. And I can also highly recommend Scott Sonnenschein's book. He wrote a book called Stretch, which is a more popular management book, but I think it's very inspiring, and also helps students to get a gist on this idea of seeing the potential in things. I really love using this specifically in my teaching for innovators, because they also can get stuck in this idea that they, you know, they lack the resources they need. But I think there's many potentials of using also underutilized resources in an organization, for example.
Fantastic,
those
Flo.
Would be my
Perhaps
two
you can
recommendations.
drop the references into the chat, and any other ideas, please,
yeah, we'll
everybody
do.
Should share those via chat. Thanks very much, Flo. That's wonderful and a great introduction, I think, to Julia's presentation on open strategy.
Okay, hello everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, also from my side. Thank you, Richard, for setting this up and for inviting me. And thank you, Fleur, for setting the scene now for open strategy. My presentation is a little bit different, as I decided to talk about the concept. I see many faces and names who are quite familiar with open strategy already, but I know there are also many who might not have been as much in touch with the concept itself. So I thought I'll take the chance to introduce the concept, its origins, and what it is all about, and also talk a little bit about what research has been doing so far and what might be further ways and further avenues. And then I realized I only have 10 minutes, which is quite a challenge, but let me try. So I'll try to be quick and we can continue in the chat afterwards. So just to go a step back and reflect on what strategy and strategy processes are typically are, how we perceive them. They're typically the domain of small exclusive groups, small top management teams, executives, CEOs, and they are somehow treated with secrecy. I'm a little bit exaggerating here, but we all know that those processes might be reality in many organizations, and there might be some limitations related to it, limitations and biases related to homogeneous teams, but also problems related to the implementation that we heard that is so important, and creating the commitment of actors who are responsible for implementing and acting on those strategies that are typically developed in those settings. But let me tell you the story of some different processes. There is a small company in Austria. It is active in the high-tech connected systems area, and in the last years it has experienced hypergrowth. So it grew from 25 employees to 550, and in order to get everybody along, there were a lot of acquisitions and growth, they used social media, they used an app, a network, where they share not only operational and social information, but also a lot of strategic information. Where do we want to go? What are our goals? What are the numbers? What are strategic decisions that will be taken? Why were they taken the way they were taken? So everything is really shared. People have it on their smartphone. It is on screens, in the facilities, in the productions. So a huge level of transparency. Another example that some might be familiar is the Navy. The Navy is a very secretive organization that engaged in crowdsourcing to collect ideas for their new aviation strategy, input from external people, but also people from within the Navy. And they got a lot of ideas that they implemented in their investment plans and that were highly disruptive. We have other examples, Ericsson, telecommunication company from Sweden that have set up this online community, and there are already some papers researching specific aspects of this community, where you have an online community where everybody within the company, no matter regardless of their rank, of their function, of their tenure or experience, are invited to engage in really in-depth discussions on future trends of the industry, on management practices, and so on. And finally, I have the example of a European steel producer who also faced a lot of challenges in this industry in terms of competition, overcapacity, sustainability, and who invited people from within the organization, but also external experts from very different fields to engage in a very intensive workshop setting to just develop ideas or business models that could heavily disrupt this industry. So what do all those examples have together? We have a process that is opened up somehow, that is more transparent, much more strategic information is shared, or additional actors are invited and included in the process itself. And this is exactly how open strategy as a concept has been defined and is currently perceived, where we have those dimensions of transparency, sharing more information to internal or external audiences, or including actors from outside the top management team. And that could be very, very different actors, could also be other organizations, as we saw in the example of FLIR, where organizations are together engaging in strategizing. The important thing is, and I think we have stressed that very often, and a lot of studies are already building on this, is that it's not a yes or no decision. There are very different degrees and scope of openness on both dimensions. And organizations can dynamically move back and forth between being more open or more closed, either depending on time, depending on the phase of the process. So there are many different contingency factors. And most recently, I do want to add that there is this paper of Violetta Splitter and colleagues that adds and suggests this additional dimension to openness, where we do not only talk about transparency and inclusion, but also decision rights, distributing decision rights to a broader audience. Now, that's where we, I would say, currently stand in terms of understanding this concept, this phenomenon that we observed in those organizations and how we make sense of it. And what we did last year is to just review everything, or at least some studies that have engaged from a strategist practice perspective with open strategy to make sense of it. And I can't summarize everything, but just to give you some ideas of what is the current status here. Obviously, as it is mostly rooted in the strategy practice domain, we see a lot of qualitative studies deeply engaging with different cases of openness using different rich data in terms of interviews, ethnography, archival data. We have very different types of organizations that have been studied, large international ones, public institutions, but also small ventures, small and medium-based, family-based enterprises, huge variety of cases. In terms of geographic reach, I was thinking and having a look at the database, and to my perception, it's mainly US and European based companies, some examples of South American companies. I think that is mainly the geographic reach in terms of organizations studies. What we also found is mostly we have, of course, cases that have been on purpose selected because they were somehow labeled as open, most, not all of them. And many of them investigate aspects where the openness was somehow a time-limited initiative. There are differences. The Ericsson example is an ongoing initiative where we have openness on a continuous basis. So just to give you some brief insights on what the studies have been about. The first was many engage with different kind of practices, either practices related to transparency or inclusion, understand what's going on. And here we found, obviously, digital technologies play a major role, as I've mentioned, crowdsourcing examples, social networking apps, online platforms. So a lot, not all, but a large number of studies, and I just give you an overview here, focus on the role of digital technologies somehow as material enablers here. One example, and I don't go through all of them, is a study looking on different IT-mediated practices that are used when opening up the strategy process. Or we have a study looking at crowdsourcing and what might be really those characteristics of crowdsourcing that dematerialize material barriers in terms of, for example, anonymity, parallelism in crowdsourcing initiatives, process structuring. We have a study, for example, looking at a digital visualization tool and its role in helping employees using this tool in the strategy process to improve understanding. Another aspect, and that relates to the definition that I was referring to, that we have those dimensions where you can move along our temporal dynamics. As I've mentioned, practices, and this is the first study all about, might change over the life cycle of an organization. We have a study that looked at how the different dimensions precede each other. So there was a study looking on how transparency on a digital platform precedes inclusion. Or, and that's always an interesting one because it leads me to the next one, this study of Stjane and colleagues in the Journal of Management Studies. They show how openness over time slowly infiltrates the strategy process from the bottom. And as I've said, that brings me to this next area. Many of those examples that I brought, they are really about management decided to open up the strategy process and increase inclusion or transparency. But of course, it could also happen somehow bottom up, uncontrolled, as we have seen in this study, where openness was really behind the back of management's becoming a reality, and then they had to engage in accommodating and legitimizing this openness. And just one final study, and then I'm coming to the future implications. We have also seen that transparency and inclusion, and that's an example here that is not necessarily controlled and managed, of course, can lead to undesired outcomes, can lead to, in this case, it's about emotions and escalating conflict. But this is also a theme in the different studies. What might be risks, what might be costs, what might be problems associated with the different dimensions, with the different practices, and with the newly included actors. So finally, to come to the future research avenues, obviously, as it is always the case, also artificial intelligence is something that has been discussed in the context with openness. And I had discussions with other scholars about what is open, what is AI, and if we use generative AI along the strategy process, are we introducing a new actor even, or is it just a new technology that we are referring to? What is it? What role does it have? Because when we look at the actors, there are many, many opportunities for future research, I would say, in terms of better understand what happens in the context of transparency, inclusion with those different actors. Not only the newly included one, the employees, the people from the external environment, but also the executives, management, CEOs, how do their roles change, their identity constructions change, what might be emotional aspects, what might be aspects related to their personal characteristics, which leads me to multiple contingency factors that could be explored in this context on an individual level, on an organizational level, on an environmental level, what influences openness, different adoptions on dimensions, degrees, levels, interplays, and so on. And finally, some methodological considerations. One related to how we pick cases. As I've mentioned so far, we have looked, or research has looked a lot on those cases that were labeled as open from the beginning. Might be interesting to also look behind that labeling. I think we would find much more examples maybe for bottom-up, uncontrolled, unmanaged openness that just emerged. And then, okay, can we move beyond the current engagement in specific cases, and also adopt quantitative approaches. And then, of course, we open up the black box of measuring openness, capturing openness in a larger scale, having experimental studies on an individual level. What does different types of openness with individuals and their perceptions and outcomes? But there are many more. Those are just some ideas that I had. If you have any questions, anything to add, I'm happy to answer.
That's fabulous. Thank you very much, Julia. As Louise has commented in the chat, we've got some great themes coming through. And I think a very large agenda building up for Siobhan at the end on methodology. So no pressure, Siobhan. But in the meantime, I'd encourage everybody to use the chat to, and there are some questions already coming through to Julia. So if Julia can respond to those questions there, I think we should probably hand over to Henk now, and let's see what we've got to say about the social value as well as economic value and how that can be incorporated into strategizing. Mm-hmm. Henk, are you all right then? Over to you. Here you are. Good. Please keep using the chat. Lots of messages coming.
Okay, can you see my screen? Yes?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Okay.
It says Henk has started screen sharing.
Great, because it worked when we did try it out.
No, it's the
moment. You still cannot see it?
No.
Then I try.
Black screen.
Right.
Start again and try.
Yeah, do it again.
Yeah. And lots of messages coming in. Oh, by the way, Louise might know the answer to this. Is everybody happy to share their PowerPoints? And what would be the best mechanism for doing so if you are? Louise, do you have a view?
No, we don't have a specific mechanism for that, but I suggest that if you're interested in a specific set of slides, you reach out directly to one of the speakers and they will share a PDF version if they're comfortable with that. But otherwise, this video will be available on the STR YouTube channel. And we also upload them as podcasts on Spotify. So there are many other ways of reviewing this or listening in to this session again. And I think a great presentation so far and very interesting discussion in the chat. So please read that. Henk, perhaps you can email your slides to Richard and Richard can share if it's...
To Louise. Louise, you're much more competent than I am.
Maybe I have a problem because I'm stuck now. I see. Maybe
just log out.
Next presenter can go first
and rejoin. But otherwise, next speaker goes first. Yeah.
Yeah, but I will also log out because I'm fully stuck. I don't know what's happening.
Send the slides to Louise and me just in case as a backup.
Yeah.
Siobhan, are you all right? Are you ready to go? I've lost you on. Siobhan? I think we've lost Siobhan as well.
Sorry, no, no, I'm here. Mute. I'm here.
Oh, great. Thank you. Can you go now, please? Which is actually to put you back into the original order. And Hank will have a chance to catch up.
I just need Hank to let me screen share.
Ah.
He's got to stop, I think.
Hank, can you hear us?
I think he logged out. Try now, Siobhan. I think it was linked at one participant can share at a time. Now we've got multiple participants can share at a time. So
sorry. Okay. Thank you. So there's so many trends going on that everyone has brought up. And, you know, from economic and social to open, interorganizational, AI, political, economic stability. I'm going to take a bit of a back to basics approach, if that's okay. And I'm going to start with field work. So I echo Callan's call for the importance of field work and think about how we study strategy in the field today, given all this. There are lots of good reasons to study strategy in the field. I think it's a great lens into the how. It's a great lens into the meaning. I think how people are forming and implementing strategies. And I'm thinking of the 2x2 we just saw about transparency and inclusion. I don't know if you're going to find that in any existing database. And we do know that field research can provide really novel, interesting insights. May not be great for some of the traditional questions about attractiveness of industries and optimal strategic positions and firm performance. Don't worry about that. Don't stress over that. Because there's lots of really good and important terrain out there that we just don't really have answers for. So I'm going to, as both in my role as a methods person and editor at ASQ, point in the direction of where I think there's lots of good white space or blue space. You know, I think how firms form their strategies, the criterion process they use. So we just heard about open strategies, what inputs, who's in the room? How do firms test their strategies? There's a lot of exciting work on entrepreneurialism and experimentation. How does that unfold? And what role do templates play? So we just heard about strategy implementation, execution, and that it can happen in varied ways and with consequences for the group, for the firm, for the culture. How do firms create differentiation? We know it's important. And how is interdependence of strategic elements coordinated? So I've been doing some work on strategy change, which I'm going to talk about on these fronts, like when, how, and why do firms make strategy changes? How do people tolerate change? Is there a point at which it's too much and they check out? And the consequences of strategy change. So I'd like to ask a provocative question, which is, what if we took our own definition of strategy seriously? Our definitions of strategy talk about strategy as not one thing, but many unique sets of integrated activities, alignment of different interdependent strategic elements produced by patterns of decision-making. But we tend to study strategy as if it's one monolithic thing, but it is not. To be put into action, strategy has to be decomposed. So there may be elements or initiatives or goals or objectives. We just saw the human development goals on a few slides ago. There may be acquisitions and mergers and reconfigurations, the way Samina Karim studies them. There may be positions on a landscape. And all that movement and activity, once it's broken down, has to somehow create strategic alignment. And to me, this is very much like a rabbit coming out of a hat. So I think it's super hard for managers and leaders to do. And I think it's even harder for us to study. So amidst all the changes going on with new modes of strategy, if we take our own definition seriously, then we have to think about how to make it really tractable. So I have a piece with Misha Miller and Susan Cohn, who are on this call as well. It just came out in Org Science. And what we did is we traced three kinds of strategy elements over time. So we looked at changes in products, markets, and resources, like what people were selling and where. Channels is kind of embedded in there. And then how they changed the resources. And we looked at that over time to see which changed. So we started with advice and how people got advice into strategy. And we found that only firms that co-produced advice, we translated, tested it, and basically incorporated advice into strategy. These firms tested more broadly. They didn't just test more, they tested more different things. So in other words, new types of tests. And I think that's something that could only come from field work, where we weren't just looking that they tested, but where and what. And those firms that tested more in new markets also, they changed their products and their markets and their firm resources more and ended up with a broader scope. At the same time, I have the piece out with Jax Kirtley from Wharton that came out in SMJ this month. And we did a similar thing looking at the pool of decisions to see which turned to change. And by that, we looked at change can also be decomposed. So we looked at additions to strategy and exits from strategy and when those changes produced a pivot. So from that, we saw that pivots were not the product of a single change, but an accumulation of exits and additions. So if this is true, we have a big job on our hands. We have to examine multiple types of changes at the same time over time. So this should directly make us think harder about research designs. So I think one of the things that was mentioned earlier is, you know, what people say and what people do and how these differ. So there are symbolic strategy changes we can look at, right? Sense making frames, all the tools people use to talk about strategy. There are substantive strategy changes, decisions, actions, plans, changes in manufacturing, timing of market entering, use cases. And then there are how we execute, as Callum was saying, like changes in people, groups, channels, delivery, and structure. So a big task for us is to think about the relationship across these. And so if you think about Bergelman's famous 1994 ASQ paper with Intel, I think Intel actually changed their manufacturing of DRAM before they changed their official strategy. When IBM was doing open source, there was a very funny come to Jesus moment where they said, no one's doing open source until you tell me why, because people were doing it without a strategy. So what comes first? How does the symbolic relate to the substantive? How does the frames and the changes relate to what happens in parallel versus in sequence? How are different types of changes aligned and maybe tested or trialed? And then, I think Chen Gao, who's also on this call, has some interesting work. Like, to what degree can people really repurpose and reallocate? And then, as Callum talks about, you're going to need different groups to execute, and how are they going to handle it? So I view this job of strategic alignment as incredibly difficult with the environmental changes discussed earlier, as long as the decomposition and reintegration. So I think of some common pathologies that may be familiar to people, like addition sickness, where people tack on strategic initiatives onto what exists already, rather than creating true change or alignment, where addition is disguised as strategy. There's also change addiction, which some of you may be familiar with, where there's continuous reorganization and realignment and moving of deck chairs, where reorganization is disguised as strategy. And I've been working with IBM for several years, and anyone who's been there long enough knows that the insiders call the firm, I've been moved. So, you know, both pathologies are present in a lot of organizations, and both undermine the work of strategic alignment. So I'm really curious about how we decompose strategy and how we create alignment and what those practices and patterns and processes look like, because to me it seems like magic. So I encourage people to get in the field and tackle problems like these. I love some of the research that we talked about today. I think it's like settings on the edges where the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. Looking at what people say and do and the gaps in between, that means you have to come at these problems with multiple data sources. If you're tracking different kinds of change at the same time and across different elements, you need to have multiple measures in whatever direction you're going in. And I love people to really think about, if we're to deliver on this integrated set of unique activities, well, what are they? How do we decompose the idea, the abstraction of strategy, and observe how people take action and integrate this to create that beautiful alignment that we theorize about? Thank you. Really been a pleasure, Richard. Thank you for organizing.
Thank you so much, Siobhan, and thank you for stepping in and doing a nicely, perfectly timed presentation. I think I should hand over to Henk now. You're the future, and evenly distributed, I hope. But I think the point you made, Siobhan, is a lot of the phenomena we have are kind of outliers, but they may be much more general patterns in the future. Henk, thank you. Your slides are showing very well, except not in presentation mode.
Now they do, I hope.
No, but I'm sure that doesn't matter too much.
Now I can solve this, just duplicate settings.
There's some of us here who speak Dutch, but I don't.
Yeah, can you see it now?
That's it, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hello from... Henk in the rainy Amsterdam, and it's really great to join the show, and I really like the presentations. Apologies for the inconvenience caused. I would like to discuss some emerging research I'm doing, strategizing for purpose, balancing economic and societal value. Purpose, is it a new mode of strategizing? Well, I think in traditional strategizing, maybe also Julia referred to that, it's about your mission, the business domain, your vision, your goals. But we mainly address the economic license to operate, but fail to address the social license to operate. And that's more and more important. Also considering increased regulation we have, for instance, in the EU, we have the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, but also on national level, we have all kind of corporate governance codes that, press firms to focus also more on their societal value. For instance, in the Netherlands, that is sustainable long-term value creation. But it's not only a European development, also, of course, in the United States, the CEO pledge to focus not only on shareholders, but also on stakeholders. And actually, we also have new activists, shareholders that not only stress shareholder value anymore, but very important, for instance, Larry Fink stressing that if a company doesn't have a purpose, you should not invest in that company. Now, of sure, a lot of this is more symbolic, but I think purpose is a very relevant topic. And so we started a research project on this topic with actually... three main questions. So what are the drivers for purpose for firms? For most firms, it is more external driven. Some firms, it's more internal driven by, let's say, ideas of the founder or CEO. What are the outcomes? But in this presentation, I would like to focus on the practices of purpose-driven firms. So what do purpose-driven firms do differently in comparison to firms that do not have a purpose or are not purpose-driven? Of course, lately there's a lot of attention for corporate purpose in the strategy literature. There was a special issue in strategy science, also a piece in general management from George et al. If you look at the literature, you could make a distinction between two categories: the goal-based perspective. That's more in line with the traditional strategy literature. It's very much focused on an objective that doesn't have to have a societal value, and a more duty-based perspective, much more focused also on the ethical and moral position of the firm. And if I would have to define the concept of corporate purpose, I'm more in line with this duty-based perspective. And here I quote the definition of Henderson, a concrete goal or objective for the firm that reaches beyond profit maximization or the one of Colin Meyer to produce profitable solutions to the problem of people and planet, and not to profit from producing problems for people or planet. But I think essentially, very essential for a purpose-driven strategy is that the purpose should relate to the core activities of the firm, and it should just lie at the heart of the organization and should be based on a viable business model. Now, maybe you think, what's the difference from CSR or sustainability. Well, firms can invest in CSR or sustainability, but it's very often peripheral and not focused on their core activities. Now, if you, based on this definition, you can distinguish various positions. So most firms probably fit more with this dual model. So they, most of their activities are just focused on economic value creation. Some firms have more a partly converging model. So, well, some of the activities there, we see a synergy between the activities that create economic value and also create societal value. But for the others, the focus is pure on economic goals or societal goals. And of course, the third position where there is really synergy between their economic activities and activities that also are beneficial for society. And of course, this is more a position for B Corps or for social enterprises. But in this study, we focused more on for-profit organizations and how they do develop a corporate purpose. So what we did is a literature study, a big survey, and 10 case studies in several companies. And we were mainly interested in companies that are active in contested industries or sin industries. So, for instance, we also included Shell, KLM, also Heineken. And we interviewed the board, the CEO, the work council members, but also the external stakeholders. And based on all those interviews, we, of course, did some coding. And based on this coding, we developed a kind of process model on strategizing for purpose. And so we distinguished on the left side of the model different antecedents of corporate purpose, internal or external. Also positive and negative outcomes of corporate purpose. But in this presentation, I would like to focus on the practices. And so we came up with a distinction between some formal practices and informal practices of corporate purpose. And let's start with the formal ones. What do purpose firms do, driven firms? Well, they have purpose statements, but they should be specific, long-term oriented, and quantified, and they should be pro-social. And to give an example, so PwC, our purpose is to build trust in society and solve important problems. Of course, that's a very superficial purpose. Well, for instance, the purpose of Randstad is much more concrete and measurable. By 2030, we will touch the work lives of 500 million people worldwide. Another practice is incentivizing for purpose. So the strategy is aligned with the purpose. They develop key performance indicators linked with the purpose. And also the remuneration of the board is also linked to the achievements of the purpose. Here you see, for instance, Randstad, where nearly a quarter of their bonuses are linked to the purpose. But there are also other firms like DSM, where even more than 50% of the remuneration or the bonuses of the board are related to the purpose. Of course, also onboarding of the purpose is very important. Nice example is Heineken, where they had the Heineken Manifesto. They came up in a meeting with 250 of their top managers. So that the core values of the purpose are also really disseminated. And another practice is that those firms also engage with their external stakeholders via stakeholder dialogues and different partnerships. And a nice example is here, the Port of Rotterdam. They have what they call a pilot light program, but they are always in touch with their stakeholders to continuously calibrate their corporate purpose. Of course, there are also informal practices. So the culture should be aligned with the purpose. Of course, it should be endorsed by the top management team, top managers, and also employees should internalize the purpose. And here, WC is a nice example where they do this kind of, they measure the so-called value survey, and they try to measure on an annual basis to what extent they achieve the values of their purpose. Actually, based on this model and coding of the interviews, we also derived a kind of typology, a conceptual model with two dimensions. On the vertical axis, you see, is the purpose more internal driven or is it more externally driven? And on the horizontal axis, you see if there's really a friction between the economic and versus the societal goals, or is if there's a kind of balance or synergy between the economic and social goals. And you see on the left box there, you see a reactive dual purpose. Shell is a typical example of that. These are firms in which the drive for purpose is more external because of regulations, governments, etc. And also there's still a big friction between the economic goals and the societal goals. Most firms are there left under. Then you see a proactive dual purpose. Here, the purpose is more internal driven, but there's still a tension between economic and social goals. NXP Semiconductors is a nice example since they have now a German CEO. The former CEO was a CEO for the United States, very much focused on shareholder value. With the new CEO, the focus is now more, also more purpose-driven, but still there is a big friction between the economic activities and the more societal goals they want to achieve. Then you see a reactive converging purpose, examples PwC and also KLM. Well, the here you see really a pull for purpose. I think for KLM, it was particularly the Dutch government, and PwC, it was the financial authority. So the purpose doesn't come from, it's not intrinsic, but they are pretty successful in aligning their economic activities with the more societal activities. And then, of course, a proactive converging purpose. Those are companies where the purpose is intrinsically driven, and there's also a real balance and synergy between the economic and societal goals. Philips is a nice example. Another company you probably not know is Protix, but they produce protein based on insects. This is a very CEO, very much driven by how to increase sustainability. So these are examples of really strongly purpose-driven firms. Actually, there are different journeys how to get there. There's an outside-in journey or a pull for purpose. You see the red arrows here in the quadrant. Alternative is a more push for purpose. It's more inside-out journey. There it starts with mostly the board or CEO coming up with a purpose and then trying to achieve really synergy between economic and societal goals. So the contributions of this emerging work still in process. I think
in just a moment, Henk, because we might take your last question as well.
Oh, sorry. I finish here then.
Are you sure? Okay, go.
Maybe one short advertorial. I think also in our teaching, we need to have more attention in strategy teaching on corporate purpose. So we just published a new book on strategic management with chapter 3 only focusing on direction and purpose. And there's also two special issues, one in long-range planning, but you cannot submit anymore. But if you want to submit, we're now working on a special issue for European Management Review. Deadline, end of March. I'll stop here.
Fabulous. Thank you, Henk. A quick question to you, perhaps about the special issue. And then I think we should close with thanks to everybody. But if anybody has a quick question, please do put it to Henk. I've lost you, Henk. Oh, there you are, Henk. Right. Or indeed, there's one or two questions coming up, one from Amisha. Do you want to respond to that very quickly, Henk?
Yeah, no, I think these are all very good questions. Of course, the main question, which we didn't consider, because I only talk now about the practice, is a purpose more symbolic? Yeah, for some organization it is, and therefore you also see the negative outcomes, because if the purpose is symbolic, and you know the stakeholders notice that the firm is not really delivering on its purpose, it's really pushing back. But this is these are, so purpose washing is one of the main questions we also considered in this study, but we try to focus on the practices that those firms have in comparison to firms that are not purpose driven at all.
Thank you, Henk. And your, is it European Management Review special issue will no doubt be considering that further.
Sure, sure, for sure.
Let me finish, because everyone's busy, by a really sincere and full thanks to the panelists, all five panelists. It's been wonderful. Some of you I know and some of you I haven't really met before, and it's been a lot of fun for me. I hope it's been great for the audience as well. Thank you very much for all your questions and some suggestions as well about readings. And with that, I also should thank the Strategy Division for giving us this opportunity to meet and interchange in between those big, big jamborees which happen every August. I think this is a great way of continuing conversations throughout the whole year. Thank you very much, everybody.